Stop. Stop. Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
It's the Saturday night edition of State Sovereignty Show, brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Missouri Grassroots Radio. As always, that guy on the other end of the table there is Mike Slack. How you doing, Mike?
Doing well, Dave. Really well.
Great. As mentioned by Mike, I am Dave. Tonight we have a great show. We're going to get right into it here in just a minute. We have Laura Hausladen. You remember her from last week when we talked with her about fair and honest elections. She is from Missourians for Honest Elections and Missourians for Sound Money. And then we're going to be joined here in a bit also by Doreen Hannes from the Liberty Roundtable and the Truth Farmer. We're going to talk to them about the Speaker of the Missouri House. Laura's here already. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm fine.
Great.
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Mike, carry on while I see if this isn't Doreen.
Okie doke. And, well, Laura, I think Dave said Speaker of the House. Actually, Mr. Deal right now is floor leader, isn't he, or am I mistaken?
Oh, you're correct. He's just presumed to be the next Speaker of the House because with the pre-election that the House had, he is slated to be the next Speaker.
And it kind of like it's his turn now, the state party apparatus has decided that he's done what he needs to do, and it's his turn to be Speaker. Is that, at least that's the impression I get. Do you think I'm accurate with that?
You know, I couldn't tell you specifically why, if it's a state party apparatus or just
You kind of rise to this position by being loyal, by having political ambitions, by being loyal to the leadership, you usually rise to it by promotion. You're the majority leader, and then you're a whip, and then you're you hold some of these leadership offices, and you prove yourself valuable to the leadership obstructing things the leadership doesn't want done, and by promoting things the leadership does want done, by carrying a heavy hammer for the leadership. And then you get handpicked and groomed for this position, and then you move into it.
Kind of like being, what was the fellow in The Godfather, Luca Brasi? Kind of like being Luca Brasi for,
Yeah.
The consigliere's hitman.
Yeah.
We were,
it
and I noticed
like
you were saying he was being
quite a lot to do with
loyal
it.
To the leadership, but and doing what the leadership wants, but not necessarily doing what the people want, the voters want.
Oh yeah, well that's for sure. And we'll cover several of those things tonight. The guy's name is John Deal. He is destined to be the next Speaker of the House. He was the majority leader in the last House, in the last session.
With the floor leader.
Floor leader, right. Floor leader, yeah, which is the next step up from majority leader. It's the second in power to the Speaker. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, Dave, during the last couple of weeks before the end of the last session, I was calling Jeff City an awful lot to check on different bills that that an awful lot of us wanted to see pass or at the very least go to the floor for a reading. And I kept hearing about good bills that were not even going to the floor for a reading. And I was asking who was responsible, and they kept telling me John Deal.
Right.
And, you know, I hadn't paid attention. I hadn't even heard of the guy until then.
Yeah.
But,
hey, has Laura, have you gone over how important the position of speaker is and how much control the speaker has over legislation? I'm sorry, I was a couple of minutes late.
It's all right.
No, we haven't talked about that yet, Doreen, but it'd be great to go over that.
Well,
that
I think that might help to lay the foundation for understanding for people, because I don't know about you guys, but I was never taught civics in my public school career, and I had no comprehension of, you know, other than like, what was that cartoon they had, this is a bill on Capitol Hill. You know, that was the extent of my education on the legislative process until actually becoming involved in it. And, you know, I mean, some of the things that are very important for people to understand is that you can have superb bills submitted by seemingly good guys, and a lot of times they are good representatives, but they won't go anywhere if the power structure does not want it to. And, you know, I think it would be a good idea to give a very quick little overview of how that power structure works, and then, you know, perhaps everyone will have a little bit more of a even plateau to understand how things are going and why this is such an issue.
Like the after-school special years ago, I remember the I'm a Bill on Capitol Hill cartoon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These
okay,
kids in my legislative education. Okay. Well, you know, first of all, you have to get a bill introduced, and the language for that bill hopefully is good, solid language. And then the bill will be read on the floor twice. They only read the title and maybe a little bit of a summary of it. And then it is assigned to a committee. And the committee chair and sometimes the co-chair of the committee will determine which bills that are assigned to that committee that they want to hear. And then they have a hearing. Go ahead.
Just didn't want to interrupt. It is the speaker that will assign the bills to the committees.
Yes.
Correct.
Exactly. And so there's one position wherein the speaker has a lot of power. And then
and
the chair
doesn't have to do it right away. So sometimes he can stall or even not assign it to committee, right?
Correct.
Yeah, I'm not actually aware of that having happened. I'm aware of the stalling process, but not of a bill not being assigned.
I haven't known of it not being assigned, but certainly the stalling is a big issue.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Right. Yeah, well, it takes a long time. It takes a lot longer to get anything that's actually good through all of these processes than something that's garbage, you know. That slides right through. okay, so it goes to a committee eventually. The committee chair and co-chair are very, very powerful, and they decide which ones are going to receive a hearing, and then there's a hearing, and then there's a process to get the bill out of the committee, and that is called an exec session where they vote on it. Sometimes they'll do that right away. Sometimes they'll put it off. Sometimes they'll never do it. Okay, so it can die in committee. Okay, and if it gets through the committee, gets voted out of committee, then it goes to the Rules Committee, and then from the Rules Committee, it goes into the queue to possibly be brought up on the floor. And Laura, maybe you can cover some of that with regard to Deal, because if he doesn't want something on the floor, if the speaker doesn't want something on the floor, it's guaranteed to not get on the floor, you know?
Right.
But
right. That's what a lot of people found last year with Deal as floor leader. He had no intention of putting certain bills on the floor. Some reps, we were even told by a rep who possibly was for the bill we were working on, but he would not lift a finger for it because he knew that deal was against it. So he just told us, why are you even trying when deal is against this bill, because it's not going to go anywhere. So, yeah, it's both the floor leader and the speaker. They kind of work in conjunction usually. But either one of them can keep a bill from going anywhere.
And in my experience, and, you know, there are others who are tremendously more experienced than myself, but if either the floor leader or the speaker don't desire to get a bill on the floor, it just doesn't go there, okay? So Mike was talking about the calls that he made near the end of session last year and kept on hearing that Representative John Deal, as floor leader, was the one who was stopping it from going to the floor. So the floor leader and the speaker are arguably, I mean, they are the most powerful positions within the representative body up in Jefferson City. So we need to get somebody in those positions that is really, really interested in freedom and state sovereignty and upholding the Constitution of the state of Missouri with its original intent. And Deal simply doesn't have those characteristics. So
okay,
I've heard Governor Nixon called an emperor, but it sounds like Deal is king of the hill.
In the representative side of our elected officials' bodies, yes, he is. And then on the Senate side, we have the same issue with the pro tem. So, you know, it isn't simple to get a positive piece of legislation through both houses and to get it through clean. It's really pretty close to impossible.
So my social studies teacher lied to me.
Now I keep reading everywhere, on almost every press release, on almost every media outlet, that the next Speaker of the House is John Deal. Is that already a done deal?
It's not, actually. The actual vote is the one that really counts. Is taken on the first day of session. So at that point, it would be official. And at one point, I don't know exactly when, maybe Doreen does, but some years back, they didn't have this pre-ordaining of the Speaker of the House. But recently, whenever they changed it to make it a year in advance, they kind of picked the person, they nominated them, and had an election in the House of the Representatives choosing. That supposedly they did because they thought it took a while for somebody to get up to speed and to get into the groove, so they wanted to give them a heads up. But it could very well be that, I mean, it looks to me like the real reason they did that was so that that person could raise a lot of money, have a lot of time for lobbyists to have influence with him. For example, John Deal in the last year has raised over $700,000, which has come in from PACs and lobbyists and companies. And so that, I think, is a big problem, that we've had this preordaining of the Speaker of the House. And I know Bev Allen of Concerned Women for America, she was the one that told me, because she's had much more experience than I, that it used to be that they would just have the election and then on the first day of the session, and then that person would be Speaker of the House. They wouldn't have it a year ahead so that they could be all primed with all this money.
So,
right.
So the system we currently live under, they will actually elect the Speaker of the House on the first day of the 2015 session.
That will be the official vote. And that will be on the floor, and it'll be, you know, if you've gone there and you've seen how the board lights up and everybody's name tells who they're voting for, or yes or no, I'm not sure how they work.
I think it's just yes or no on the speaker vote. It's yay or nay.
But it's not a secret ballot like the one in the U.S. House of Representatives is.
It is not a secret ballot.
Okay. All right. Now, let me ask you another question. Is that the only elected position? Does the speaker then go ahead and appoint these other leadership positions, or are they also voted on by the caucus?
Doreen?
I believe
Laura is also elected, correct?
I'm sorry, Laura,
which is
you
also
cut out.
I think the floor leader is also elected, but
okay.
I believe that all the chairmanships are given by the speaker.
Oh, yes.
That's
correct. I know that. But now, once I get past the floor leader, I'm talking about the majority leader and what we have a different name in Missouri for the whip, but it's a woman now. I forget what that position is called. I'll have it during the break. I'll go to and find it. But those positions now, are they voted on? Now, I know that, like, the majority leader and this other coordinator who's the whip, I know these people aren't elected by the entire Senate or the House. They would be elected by the caucus if they're elected. But are they elected or are they appointed, or do we know?
I think that they are elected. I think the floor leader is elected, but I'll do a quick search on this. I know for a fact that the speaker is, and then the speaker appoints all of the chairmen, and I believe that the caucus vote for the Democrat and the Republican Party determine the majority leader and the minority leader. But beyond that,
now the speaker not only appoints the chairman and co-chairman of the committee, but he also appoints the entire committee, doesn't he?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
make all the assignments.
Yeah. So he says, Joe Jones, you're on these three committees, and Mike Smith, you're on these eight committees, and whatever. So not only then does the speaker control, it seems to me, the ups and downs, but he also controls the committees.
Yes, to a very large extent. Now, usually with the committee memberships, not the chairmanship position, but the memberships, they generally take into account people's background in various fields and try to get them on committees where they have a little bit of understanding, okay? And
right.
that, you know, I mean, so that isn't illogical, and I wouldn't, you know, take umbrage with that. But they do have an immense amount of control, and
right.
the chairmanship is the big deal on the committees.
Yes.
So.
Right, and very coveted.
And I'm thinking when I hear that about a bill that I particularly was involved with, and when I say involved with, I didn't really do any work on it, but I followed it. We talked about it almost weekly here, and that was the bill to impeach the governor over the specific article of impeachment that had to do with denying Missourians of representation in Washington, or in Jefferson City. And that bill, and for the listeners that weren't with us through all that, I just want to review that real quick. That bill was stalled, as Doreen and Laura have pointed out. It wasn't even assigned to a committee for the longest time. And then... Mm-hmm. And then when it was assigned to a committee finally, and I do want to send a hat tip to the listeners, it was assigned to a committee when you folks out there in the grassroots made the calls necessary for someone to see, well, we better assign this darn thing to a committee and right away. But it was, we're talking about, you know, 3 or 4 weeks left in the session before it gets assigned to a committee. They assigned it to the committee of Stanley Cox, which is a committee that was well stacked in favor of Tim Jones and John Deal. And set in that committee and down to about 2 weeks before the legislature was to adjourn, they hadn't had a hearing yet. And again, hat tip to the grassroots who put enough pressure on the committee chairman that he felt invigorated into calling a committee. They had a committee. And then one morning, everyone woke up, a couple of days after the committee hearing, everyone woke up to read in the press that the chairman of the committee had decided that they weren't even going to vote on this in the committee because he was pretty sure there wasn't enough to pass it out of committee. Now, a poll of the committee members indicated that it would have passed out of committee. But the chairman of this committee stalled it and then killed it single-handedly. So this is the kind of, and this was a henchman, this particular chairman was a henchman for Tim Jones and John Deal, and the bill was specifically appointed to that committee for that reason. And so I just wanted to remind all of our listeners of that process to amplify what Laura and Doreen were talking about. So go ahead. I interrupted somebody when I went off on that rabbit chase.
Well, that
was an important example. That was a good example. Yeah. And Stanley Cox was not only, he was termed out, so there
right.
was no chance that he, you know, could be influenced by the voters at all.
And
right.
And just to reward us at the grassroots, he went on to lose his election for a county judgeship up in Sedalia. so he's now back in the private sector where people like that belong.
Right. I did a quick little search, and I found out that the floor leader is actually picked by the party.
Okay.
So the controlling party.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So again, what we're looking at here is predominantly the party power
right.
issue, you know, and how much sway over the people that the general public elects that the party has control over. So
the majority, you know, the majority party elects the floor leader. The Democrats don't get a vote in that. And really, the Democrats vote for the House speakership is just kind of throwing a bone to them anyway, right? Not a single Democrat is going to vote for a Republican for the House leader. They're all going to vote for a Democrat, and so their votes are all wasted. The Republicans are going to vote for a Republican, and so a Republican is, of course, going to be the House Speaker.
Exactly.
Actually, I believe all the Democrats do vote for the – when the Democrats are not in power and the Republicans are as now, I believe that in the last – I don't know how many years, but I believe all the Democrats have just voted for the Republican.
Oh, really?
Just so.
Well, the reason that they do that is because if they don't, then the person can hold it against them and not allow, you know, their issues to effectively be heard in committee.
Okay, so now let me ask this, okay? Because since it's quite apparent that people like Tim Jones and John Deal are really just undocumented Democrats, are we beating our heads against the wall if all the Democrats are going to vote for John Deal? What have we got to work with here?
I think what we have to work with here is to bring somebody else up who is actually a grassroots representative standing generally for sovereignty and freedom issues, and get there to be some choice in the House.
Now,
and, you know, and we can do that.
Okay. Is there
right.
a nominating process? Does someone have to raise their hand and say, pick me, pick me, pick me? Or is
yes.
there a nominating process?
Well, it's kind of like everything else. You know, they have to go around and talk to the various representatives and see what kind of support they can garner, and then they can go for the position.
Right.
And that would be on the first day of the session in
so
January.
What we need is someone who is grassroots liberty-minded, who is constitutionally minded, and who is totally willing and capable of committing political suicide.
Yeah.
Okay, that shouldn't be hard to do.
but it isn't. You know, the issue is we can't have politicians. We have to have statesmen. Politicians have gotten
Not
us
right.
where we are, which I don't like. So if there's a statesman up there in the General Assembly who has the testicular fortitude to stand for what he believes in, to stand up for what's right, and to do the right thing and try to represent the actual people of Missouri and not the Republican Party power policy, then that person needs to step forward, and we need to support them with our
oh.
representatives and with everything that we have in us.
Absolutely,
if they will
yeah.
stand for liberty.
Yeah. No, I was I absolutely agree with you. I was not trying to be negative on that when I said commit political suicide. I mean, the person needs to stand up for that, knowing that if they lose, it's over for them, just like the person we need to find to stand up against Roy Blunt in 2016. You know, I mean, that person needs to stand up. They need to stand for what is right, and they need to stand there knowing that as far as the Republican Party is concerned, they are finished, win or lose. But I agree with you 100%. We need to go looking for that person.
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily equivocal to political suicide. I think it really equates more with, you know, what is your level of personal integrity and where do your principles actually fall?
Oh,
and
no.
that's the issue that we have to push with our own representatives, whether or not they have the wherewithal, if you will, or the experience to take up the House leader position, the Speaker of the House position.
Right.
You know, they have to stand up
no.
and, you know, and then you have to have someone who has those qualities in position and also has that testicular fortitude. And I don't really think it's necessarily political suicide because, you know, the party leadership needs to get knocked over. I mean, that's an obvious fact to those of us
now,
who are involved in freedom movement.
Are you being in some way anti-feminist when you say testicular fortitude? Because there may be someone
no.
who qualifies for this position who has no testicular test for various geometric reasons.
She
no,
would have
it's a, you know. No, I don't.
Okay.
I just mean, you know, having their convictions be
just
strong enough, not necessarily having to be endowed with male genitalia. Sorry. you know, but it's a rough thing.
Yes. Okay.
So then,
where do we go from there? Well, folks, this is it. You know, you've got these two suitcases up here. And I'm offering you a chance to trade the suitcase that you have in your hand for the one that is over there on the shelf. It's deal or no deal, and that's the question. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk to Doreen and Laura and Mike a little bit more about what specifically now that we've said a lot about how we need to get John Deal replaced as the heir apparent to the throne, about how we need to find someone with conviction who will step up and who we can get then the support for. We need to come back. I mean, we can't just leave it at that. We need to come back and we need to start defining exactly and specifically what is wrong with John Deal for Speaker of the House when we return.
You see the lambs in the ghetto who worship their Geppetto, believing it never seems the strings they think bind them. So we write to our congressmen with bleeding pins of the sorrow within, and pretend they just send tickets to the latest Tom Hanks show. Welcome.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Brain.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have, because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families, and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's every
Hello?
Doreen?
Yeah.
I hear you.
So are we on?
No, I'm back. I'm back. I forgot to turn on my microphone. I was just carrying on here, I had turned off my microphone during the break because I had to cough, and I forgot to turn it back on. Mike has dropped off. Because Mike has dropped off because he couldn't hear me, and I assume thought something was wrong with him. He'll be calling right back in. But anyway, I was taking a minute and 13 seconds here before we get back to it, guests, to apologize to the listeners for last night. Last night we had a great show lined up. We had huge numbers. Most of those people are back tonight, I believe. And at about 32 minutes into the program, we ran into a terrible technical difficulty, either with Blog Talk Radio or with the Internet connection to Blog Talk Radio. I'm not sure what the problem was, but we just suddenly shut off. We're going to try to get Bob Parker, who was our scheduled guest for last night, back. We'll be talking also next week with Mike Moon with the specifics about the veto session. And we'll be talking with what's the libertarian's name, Mike?
Rick Vandiver.
Yeah. Vandiver. Okay. Who is the libertarian candidate down in Moate? We've already talked to the Doug, the Constitution Party candidate. We've already talked to the young lady who is the independent candidate. And next week we're going to talk to the libertarian candidate in that one race, the race that it, for the seat that is currently held by Republican incumbent Jason Smith. So that's all on the slate for last week, and part of that should have been last night, listeners. I'm sorry for whatever it is that happened. I still don't know what happened, but we lost out. You lost out, and we apologize to you and to Bob Parker. Okay, back to the subject at hand. We are blessed tonight with Doreen Honnes of Liberty Roundtable and Truth Farmer, and Laura Houseladen, of Missourians for Honest Elections and Missourians for Sound Money. And Mike, of course, is with us. So I throw the table open again to the specific question of why do we have such heartache with John Deal as Speaker of the House. Go ahead. You start, Laura. You've had some actual personal experience sitting in the man's office.
yes. His leadership style is very heavy-handed, and I think probably the worst thing is that he cannot be entreated. He's not entreatable. If you have information, he doesn't necessarily want to hear it. With the paper ballot bill, which we worked on, we knew that we were going to have problems with John Deal from the very beginning, so that's why we pushed our bill in the Senate first and got it through the Senate with a very strong vote, almost all the Republicans voting for it. So it came over from the Senate to the House, and at that point we thought maybe he could be influenced, especially if we had canvassed the Republicans in the House and could tell him that we had the majority wishing to have this bill passed. But even when we did all of that and got a meeting with him in his office, he was adamant that he was not interested in the information that we could give him from experts in the field of computer science who had studied these machines, even the exact same kind that are used in St. Louis County. And he had no interest and told us so that he had no interest in getting this information. So with that kind of leadership, you have to wonder why would somebody be so adamant against it? And one of the people in the office said, you know, there are people around the state that are very concerned about this issue, and they want this bill to go to the floor for a vote. And he said, I don't care what the people want. So obviously that kind of a thing is a problem. And then when you put that together with the fact that there could be, he could have alliances with machine manufacturers or who knows what, because he was in charge of the Board of Elections in St. Louis County when the machines were purchased. And it's just, it's difficult to know if he's just has no interest in the people or if he has a lot of interest in himself for some monetary reasons or who knows what.
What do we know, or if he has ever received contributions?
I'm sorry?
Do we know if he's ever received campaign contributions from people connected with the machines, the companies that make them, or any financial connection? Has anyone ever found it?
The only connection that we have directly seen is with his law office, and not him specifically, but his partner has represented ES&S, the voting company that makes machines in St. Louis. He's represented them for many years and done some cases for them. And we know that John Deal took a trip to Mongolia in 2009, 2010, possibly more than one trip. He spoke with the parliament and of Mongolia and the president. This is on his resume online. And
you know, the thing that surprises me about that, though, is Mongolia only has one party, one political party.
I'm not sure that that's the case. I saw an article that said that they actually had trouble with their voting machine when they started using them, and it seemed like and the one of the parties insisted that the votes be hand counted and compared to the machines, and they were off quite substantially, I guess, in a couple of the jurisdictions or a couple of the areas.
Well, and we talked last week. You folks out there listening will remember specifically about these voting machines and their problems. But basically, what it boils down to is, in one suitcase you have fair and transparent and elections, and in the other suitcase you have these voting machines. Deal or no deal? Is that about right?
Yeah. And we could. There are many other issues. I don't know if Doreen wants to talk about.
Doreen, go ahead. Have a turn.
Well, one of the issues is the red light camera bill, and there are a myriad of issues. Now, everybody's familiar with the fact that you have these pictures that just get sent to you, and then they expect you to pay a fine for running a red light because they snapped your license plate doing so. And there are a number of problems with that. You know, first of all, it's not a crime. And second of all, it really feeds into the entire Orwellian, like, Big Brother Uber structure that we
now,
have
wait,
going
I,
on.
I want to
Go
I
ahead.
Want to stop here. I want to stop and interrupt you for just a second with a question.
Okay.
When you say first it's not a crime, you're not implying that it is not a crime to run a stoplight.
It's not a crime because if nobody got hurt. Now, if somebody got hurt because you were negligent and didn't follow the rules of the road, then you've got a crime. I mean, if you hit somebody's property or something like that. Now, this is kind of an ancillary issue. I mean, we can go down this bunny trail if you want to. But I'm pretty basic and black and white on a lot of things. If no one was harmed, then there isn't really a crime. You know, what you have is a violation of a rule of the road that is generally something that you don't want to do. But, I mean, the red camera lights, a lot of times, you know, they're sending fines to people when it was yellow. You know, that kind of thing. But, I mean, there are a whole number of issues with it, but it didn't even get assigned to committee until, or, I'm sorry, it didn't get
out of committee until 11 days after it was voted out of committee, because Deal didn't want the red light camera bill, which would prevent red light cameras within the state of Missouri. An actual police officer would have to give you a ticket instead of receiving one in the mail, you know. So he didn't even let that go out of committee, and this is the power structure and the control again. He's like, hold that, I don't want it on the floor. So if they hold it, then it doesn't get on the floor in time to make it through the process, okay? Because if it goes through the House, that's the bill that has the wheels, if you will. It goes through the House, but it doesn't get to the floor of the House until, you know, 2 weeks before the end of session. The chance of it making through the identical process in the Senate side is very slim, okay? It's very hard to get individual clean bills through both houses, especially when you're late in the session. And
exactly. That's
what happened with the red light camera bill. Now, I'm not interested in arguing whether having kind of a laborious process is the issue, because I really think that things don't need to go super quickly, but when they're killed on purpose, and it's just by a time, the clock runs out thing, then, you know, it becomes apparent what people stand for. And the word on the street on the red light camera bill was Deal did not want it on the floor.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I don't believe that's the word on the street. I believe that, and I've forgotten his name, but the guy that I talked to that really spearheads this specific issue, it was told to him pretty much the way it was told to both Mike and Laura, that leadership, quote unquote, did not want that bill out, and so that's why it didn't get out. And to interject, I agree with you that we don't need things too streamlined, and I agree with you that it's very difficult to get something through if you want it started, if you start it late. But if leadership mm-hmm. wanted it through, it would get through. And if you don't believe you can get something through, go up to the legislative session in the last week.
You can get it through.
If leadership wants it through, you can get it through in the last 7 days. So that's, you know, and that's the point. And again, we're back to the power of the leadership. My favorite, and I've already detailed the amendment or the impeachment article of Mike Moon's that I thought was the one impeachment article that really had legs, that was really well grounded and was clearly an impeachable offense. But the Convention of the States, which is another project that that I like to stay up on. And again, I haven't done a lot of work on this. I don't want to lay it out there that I've actually been doing any legwork on this particular issue, or that I'm in any way into getting this done. But we spent a lot of time on that on the show. We've spent a lot of time talking to the people who are doing the work on that. We did our part to activate the grassroots to get this thing moving. It finally, again, did get a hearing in the General Laws Committee. It was a very good hearing. There were stacks. I forget what Ron Calzone told me the number was, but it was an immense number of witness forms. There was an immense number of well-versed people testifying. People of national renown came to testify. It set after the testimony, after the hearing, until finally, again, grassroots pressure forced it to a committee vote. The committee voted it out and to the floor with about, again, 4 weeks left in the session. And it looked like there was no way of stopping this thing until Now listen, folks, when a bill is written, and I'm sidetracking here for just a second, but when a bill is written, it's not just something that the legislator sits down and writes on the on a brown paper bag and then hands into the desk. It goes to a special office who writes the bill in the specific format that it has to be written in. Now, they when the bill comes out, it should say what the legislator wants it to say, but it's written in the specific format that's required. It's passed all the muster, and then it comes out and it's read. That's the introduction. Laura talked about the first and second reading. That is the bill introduced, if you look up a bill tracking. And then it goes to this committee. Okay, it went to the committee, had the hearing, I've been through that story, came out of the committee, and then all of a sudden, just as it was ready, prepped to go to the floor, the House found an error in the title of the bill, and it had to go back and start the process all over again. Deal or no deal? That's the question. You got a favorite, Mike?
Several things that Mike Moon had promoted did not get out of committee, one of them being the direct farm-to-consumer trade bill or farm food freedom bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that it was Mr. Deal who also stopped that. And, you know, there was nothing bad about that, nothing but good. That was, you know...
It was an economic freedom bill.
Reestablishing the fact that we have a right to eat what we wish and go straight to a farmer and buy what we want. And, I was offended by that. And I would imagine Doreen was, too.
Does anyone here with us tonight, now I've heard rumors, and I'm not going to state anything here as fact, but does anyone here tonight know where John Deal stands on Medicaid expansion?
No, I have no idea.
I don't.
Okay.
Well, I just have a suspicion. Everybody that I talk to believes that he will let that go through, that is something he wants. He has recently gotten many, many donations from nursing home, hospital, medical type.
Oh,
place.
Okay.
You can go to the MEC website and do a search and see just how many tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars probably in the last year have come from that industry. But I noticed in looking at the last month or so, it seemed like there was a great deal from those industries.
Okay. I
say that's fairly telling.
Now
that's fairly telling.
Yeah, that's fairly telling. I'm being assured by people who get around up there in Jefferson City that this thing doesn't have a chance in the Senate, but that it probably will get through the House this term. That's why I'm guessing, of course, given what we've already talked about the amount of power. And the amount of control that the speaker holds over these things, that their implication that it will get through the House this term and die in the Senate is an indication to me that John Deal would at least not disfavor this. I'm sure that he's going to try publicly to keep some middle ground on it. Because there are so many in the party who are opposed to it, but I would think that those people that I know who are active in Jefferson City within the chambers, believing that it would get through the House is a strong indicator to me.
You know, David, that he. Had no problem with a 3/4-cent sales tax and voted for that and let
Correct.
That go through. That would have been the biggest tax increase in Missouri's history, and he had no problem with that. So
right.
Who knows what we're slated for.
I had a state representative tell me that there was no way that he could go against Steele, that it would be political suicide. And, you know, hearing that the votes for or against the speaker are open and not secret, that does leave them open to retaliation. But I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice if our reps considered it political suicide to support him? That if we could somehow convince them that we had a real red line, not an Obama-type red line, but a real red line, and if they did not oppose Deal this time, that their opponent
might
supported next
Right. You might let them know that, I mean, if they are a good rep putting forth good legislation that is, as Doreen says, is liberty-oriented and protection of people's rights, it's very likely that their legislation isn't going to go anywhere in the next 2 years anyway. So they might as
well.
I think that's probably the most important point right there, Laura, is, you know, if the people who are liberty-minded that we've elected into these positions don't have enough guts, I dropped the testicular fortitude, to stand against Deal on this position that's, you know, basically being handed to him on a platter, then they're not going to get their legislation to go anywhere anyway, because he is not a friend of liberty. And I think, you know, he may have done the right thing on a few liberty issues that we generally agree upon on this call here, but he doesn't do the right thing as a matter of course, and he won't let things that are truly freedom-oriented even see the light of day. And that is, that's one, it's wrong, and two, it's not helpful to those who are actually striving to increase and reclaim our freedom through their elected position. And I do think they need to see, like Mike said, they need to see supporting Deal as actually being political suicide.
Laura, I followed with great interest, and I was just so busy at the end of the session I didn't get a chance to have you on, although I wanted to. The last minute failure of the sound money bill, what happened there? Was that a deal or no deal thing?
You know, the sound money bill this year, I believe that was just kind of leadership in general, slowed that down through the House. Then it finally got over to the Senate, and
it passed the House.
It did pass the House,
but it
got to the Senate really too late to do anything. And I was more pushing the paper ballot bill this year.
Right.
It could have gone somewhere in the Senate. It still had enough time, but Ed Emery was carrying it. He was really busy with other bills, and it just never got a vote in Jay Wasson's Financial Committee. Financial and Elections Committee. That's where it died in committee.
Okay.
It was too slow getting through.
Yeah,
okay,
if it had gone through and had been, you know, gotten some good momentum, it would have been a different story.
And was it a pre-filed bill? I mean, was it introduced in the first week?
Yes, it was. Paul Kirtman had it introduced very early. And I did ask about it several times during the session. It was slow.
Which committee did it go to? Do you recall? General Laws. It doesn't matter. I just was curious. It really doesn't matter. I mean, it's all the same in the end. So what we've had so far, folks, is the Fair and Transparent Elections Bill, the Convention of the States, the Impeachment Bill, the Farm to Table Bill, the Sound Money Bill, Now, these will all be pre-filed again. These are all ready to go. Convention of the state, well, except the impeachment bill article. I know for a fact Convention of the States is ready to pre-file. I know from our discussion of last week that Fair and Transparent Elections is paper ballots is ready to pre-file. I'll assume that Sound Money is going to be ready to pre-file. The farm-to-table bill, Mike, Doreen, that going to be ready to go?
Hopefully,
I'm sure it can be.
Yeah. So we're going to have the bills ready to go. We're going to have the bills introduced early in the session. So the only thing standing between these bills getting a fair hearing, I'm not going to say all these bills will pass. They still have to go through a committee, get voted out. They still have to go to the House floor, get voted out. They've still got to go across the rotunda, get a hearing, get voted out, get to the full Senate, get voted out. It's signed by the governor and or a veto overridden. So it's still a long way to go. But what I am saying is that you've listened tonight to Laura and Doreen talk to you about how this natural progression of things can get stalled or completely derailed. The bills will be there. They'll be ready to file. They'll be ready for a fair hearing. They'll be ready to take on the obstacle course in a fair way. And that's all we ask. We don't demand that everything we want get passed the first time we send it through. All we demand is a fair shot at the obstacle course. Am I right or am I wrong?
I agree. Yeah. 100%.
So,
and there were bills too that didn't make it. And one was the data bill that would have protected. My understanding is it would have protected student and teacher data.
Right.
The anti-Common Core stuff. I know it got killed by leadership too.
On the data side of it. Right.
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 The Google.
And we talked with. We talked with Dr. Byrne about that 2 weeks ago, didn't we, Mike?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the anti-Agenda 21 stuff that didn't get through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the SAPA, the Second Amendment Preservation Act, Deal was specifically responsible for this. He waited until 20 minutes before the closing bell to send it over to the Senate. So
right.
It was.
Yep, I recall that one too. We had a talk with Ron Calzone about that one earlier. You see what we're talking about here. We're going to take another quick break as we switch gears, and when we come back, we're going to keep Doreen and Laura, and we're going to talk about what the options are. We're going to talk about how we need to do it. We're going to talk about what we need to do. We're going to talk about what we need people to do, you people, and how we get there from here.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for GrassFire Alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice, combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri.
To cold climb, come springtime, so let me hear you say, I'm gonna stand my ground.
Okay, we're back. Before we move on, I want to take about a minute and a quarter to say you are listening to the State Sovereignty Show, brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm not the only person who talks here. On Tuesday nights, Cynthia Davis comes along with her show called Homefront. If you haven't listened to Cynthia, you've missed one of the joys of life. Cynthia gets high-powered guests, nationally recognized guests, and they talk about things that have to do with maintaining the solid family structure during these progressive times and how important it is for us to maintain that structure as the basic building block of liberty. And besides that, Cynthia's a hoot. I mean, it is absolutely entertaining to spend 2 hours with Cynthia on Tuesday nights. A little change of pace on Wednesday nights. Instead of the two-hour session with one noted person, along comes Lisa Payne Nager with the Culture Vigilante. She usually can cram 6 or 7 hardcore topics into a two-hour session. Bam, bam, bam. She hits them hard. She gets the guests on that are knowledgeable, that know what they're talking about. She hits the facts. She hits the highlights. She keeps you educated and informed. And if you come away from Cynthia's program on Tuesday night entertained and enlightened, you will come away from Lisa's show on Wednesday night, I guarantee you, pissed off. She hits it hard. She tells it like it is, and she takes no prisoners. And then, of course, next Friday night and Saturday night, Mike Slack over there and me will be back with the State Sovereignty Show. We're going to deal with the veto session next week. We're going to have Mike Moon on. We always love to have Mike. He's going to tell us how it really went up there in Jefferson City for a couple of days. We're going to try hard to get Bob Parker back, and then we're going to have the Libertarian candidate for the Missouri 8. I want to let people know how fair I am. I did send out an email this week to the campaign of Jason Smith to see if he didn't want to get a shot in here. If he does, we'll have him along. We'll be glad to do it. If he ever comes along and listens to this particular show, we extend that invitation to him. We've talked to all those who oppose him up there in Missouri 8, so we want to make sure that if he cares to be heard by this large and politically astute audience, then that door is open to him. Okay, we're nearing the last hour, folks. We're in the last hour, actually. So it's time for you listeners to chime in if you want to. 347-677-1835, 347-677-1835. We've got the two knowledge fonts of knowledge here tonight with us. Laura Houselauden from Missourians for Honest Elections, Doreen Hannes from Liberty Roundtable. We've been talking about the specifics, first of all, we talked about the Speaker of the House position, what it is and why it is so important. We followed that up with the specifics about why you may want to double think or give second thought to whether John Deal is the man for the job. Now, the next thing we need to do, and we need to wrap up here with this, but we've got an hour, so don't hurry through anything, ladies. The next thing we need to do is we need to lay down the foundation of where we go from here. We know that what we need to find is a liberty-minded, constitution-loving representative, a person who will already be present by virtue of being elected to the position in the House of Representatives, who will stand up and say, I have the support. I want to be the Speaker of the House. I want to lead this body in the right direction. Now, it seems to me, Doreen and Laura, that we want to be careful not to overplay that hand. It seems to me that if you get 3 or 4 people waving their hands around saying, pick me, pick me, that all you do is guarantee the election to the christened one. Am I right or wrong on that?
Well, I think it could be problematic in that, guys, you know, because of the party power. Now, you know, I would like to see probably a choice of three, because then the actual representatives can vote their conscience, okay? And I think that that is the important thing. Right now, they're not voting their conscience. They're just voting party line and political maneuvering, and that is not healthy for those of us out here who have to live by the laws that they pass. So if we had three choices, I think that would be wonderful. Laura, do you have an opinion on that?
I don't know how it would be best. I think there'll probably have to be some, you know, talking with people behind the scenes and a plan put together. You know, I don't know, Doreen. I did want to say, though, because we hadn't mentioned it, one of the reasons why it's important, I think, that the election of the speakership go back to actually being right when the session starts is because, for example, right now we have all sorts of new legislators coming in, and they really have no say over who will be their speaker.
What are the chances that John Hill will not be reelected? Is there any chance of that at all?
I'm sorry?
Is there any chance at all that John Deal will not be reelected in November?
There is a chance because there is somebody running against him in the Democrat side of things, a gentleman named Al Gerber, and he has previously been an alderman in Town and Country, so he has some political experience. And I had a chance to meet with him. I actually have some kind of personal connections with him. He is a very good, ethical gentleman, and he is a Democrat. But it's interesting that Deal did not get as many votes as you might have expected in the August election. Of course, his primary wasn't contested, but if you look at the total number of votes that he got and the total number of votes that Al Gerber got, there was only a difference of about 500 votes. So,
what kind of percentage is that, Laura?
I don't have the percentage.
Okay.
But not in my head right now, so I'm not sure. But, you know, this is a pretty big district, so 500 votes is pretty overcomable if it really was that close. Now, we know that many Republicans voted for or took a Democrat ballot because of the Dooley race, but at any rate. So
a small chance that he wouldn't be reelected, but it's small.
Right, but there's an effort underway to speak to the Republicans in his district, and I'll be involved in this. We want to go door to door and let them know how important how important the speakership is, and ask for their help in cleaning up the House. We can't vote against Deal because we're not in that district, but we can ask them to and tell them why it's so important.
Okay, really quickly, somebody either one of our phone-in guests who are waiting in line or someone here has their radio on in the background. Let's try to turn that down for us. Okay, now, what do we... I'm sorry, I wasn't ignoring you. I was away screening some callers. But what do we do next, ladies, to find this person who will stand up for us? Do we post a sign at Craigslist or...
I think there are a few people who are kind of talking to people behind the scenes.
Okay.
And did you know, David, that there was a leadership project that was took place in 2010 when Kevin Engler was slated to be
yes.
the president pro tem in the Senate?
Right. I didn't know that.
So that was a case where, the grassroots was successful in getting best leadership.
Right.
So,
yeah, I did know
that.
And
that was a first draft battle.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah. I was following that quite closely because I later went on to lead Terry Varner's campaign against Engler when he ran for his for his Senate position, yeah. Okay, I want to skip away for just a moment. While we have Laura here, I have Neil from Alabama who's been following our shows on the voting machines, and he's here on line two, and he'd like to talk to us about some of the issues they're having down there. Neil, are you there?
I am.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for letting me on the air with you.
Sure.
I believe it was a company called Vote Count, which was a U.S. company. I believe that was the name of the outfit. Was sold to a company in France called Sictel, which George Soros has an interest in. I don't know that he's the sole owner of it, but I did read that he has an interest in it. Sictel is responsible for the vote tallies for some 500 plus electronic voting districts, and they made a statement that to the effect that once all of the votes had been gathered and amalgamated, they could not offer any authenticity to the individual votes that were gathered. Well, that's an open sore for fraud, and so I have no doubt whatsoever, and they've already had it before some guys before Congress that said they actually wrote software that was meant to defraud the American voter. So I don't know. I believe that every state should just have a hard copy voting system, a paper system. Of course, they've in the past, there's been people that worked around that too, but I think it's much more difficult. I think at least a portion of it should be some type of hard copy system where people can find out what happened to their vote.
Now, the lady who's here with us, tonight, Neil, Laura, has spearheaded the paper ballot initiative in Missouri, which, if you've been listening, failed in the last legislative session, and we'll be helping as much as we can her get that pushed in the next legislative session. Do you have such a thing going in Alabama, an initiative or a process or a proposed piece of legislation to do away with these voting machines and get back to at least a scanned paper ballot?
Well, I know that people are very upset about it as to whether it's going like, and it will come up that will be changed. I don't think it will be until there's a whole new crew put in place. And so the only way I think that you can combat that is you have to have a third party. You have to have a grassroots movement because, honestly, both parties are so entrenched now for over 100 years that you can't, I don't think that you can expect to get anything different without that. I just don't. They're corrupt.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I agree. You agree. We had a great show on that last week, a whole two-hour session about these corrupt voting machines and how they were, especially in St. Louis County here in Missouri, basically throwing elections. So we're doing something about it here. I encourage you to do something about it there in Alabama. Get a hold of your legislator and say, what are we doing in the state legislature to make sure that at least in the state of Alabama, we're still counting votes?
There was a guy in England in the parliament there back in the 1800s. His name was Benjamin Disraeli. He said the personages behind the scenes who really run government are very different people from who you think they are. And so I think rather than looking for a person that's going to do the right thing, that kind of thing, that we really need a change as well, is to simply hire people by contract to do the job and to define what they can or cannot do. For instance, if it were possible within my power to do it, I would make it against the law for anyone to ever owe taxes on their land, because people, they get older, their incomes go down, their property gets lost to the state. I just think that that's a crime. So that's just me. But there are many issues like that that certainly must be the same in your state as it is in mine or many, all of the states. So, you know, a lot of people don't think...
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Neil. Good call. I've got other callers waiting. Thanks.
Okay, man. Thank you.
I was going to jump in there for a quick second if I could. I was going to suggest that if other states...
Go ahead.
It's okay if he's not. If he's still listening, that's great.
I am.
Okay. If you're interested, you can go to our state website and get a copy of this legislation and work with your representatives within your own state to see if you can get something like that started there. I mean, this is how all of these states get the same legislation to, like, go ahead and allow federal initiatives to go through. So we can use that mechanism the same as our enemies, the enemies of freedom, do. Okay, we can take legislation that's good and positive from other states and try and work with our representatives within our own state to get a good thing done. And so you have a model that you can work from and then make it specific to your state.
Okay, I will do that. And can you tell me how it's listed?
Sure. If you go to the Missouri General Assembly website, it's moga.mo.gov, and then on the left-hand side, there's a thing for legislation, and then you click on that button, and then in the search box, put paper ballot, and that legislation should come up, and you can get a PDF or look at it just on your computer.
Fair enough. I think that's wonderful. I'll certainly go there, I promise you.
Okay.
It's house.mo.gov.
Okay. Well, you can get to it several different ways. I just gave the General Assembly one, but yeah.
You got if you go to Laura said, Neil. If you go to house.mo.gov, you can't just put in paper ballots. You have to have a bill number. And what do you know what it is, Laura?
Let's see, Senate Bill SB 623.
Okay, it was SB 623, Neil. If you want to look for it that way.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Neil. Great call.
Thank you so much. Bye bye, Neil.
Take care.
You know, and as we've clearly said, we agree with Neil 100% about the corruption in government. This is the thing that I've talked about on the State Sovereign Show 1,000 times. It's not going to do any good. I mean, we might as well give up on Washington, D.C. That's why we have to push so hard in Jefferson City. That's why we have to fight so hard for state sovereignty. That's why we have to fight, in my mind, so hard for this convention of states. And to the people who continue to say no to the Convention of States because Washington, D.C. isn't following the Constitution now, what is going to make them? Our message to them is exactly what Neil just said. We want a Convention of States. We want to repeal the 17th Amendment and go back to the way things are supposed to be. We want to repeal the 16th Amendment and take your economic power away from you and give it back to the states. We want to have a state repeal amendment. The message to you in Washington, D.C. is not that we want you to follow the Constitution. It's not that we want you to do it right. It's that we are taken over. We are taken over as of now. That Constitution belongs to us, and we are taking it back. Okay, we're going to move on to our next caller, Jason from New York. Jason has called before. How you doing tonight, Jason?
Oh, hello.
Hey, what's up?
So I'm currently speaking with the host, correct?
You are talking to me. I'm Dave, yes.
All right. You said you were a libertarian, correct?
I've said that many times, yes, sir. And I say that again and define it again, as I have 1,000 times in the past. That's a libertarian with a small L. I am not a proud member of the Libertarian Party. Go ahead.
Okay. So, Dave, I was going to ask you, what's your opinion on the ISIS and the problem in Iraq?
My opinion, and I want to throw in another caveat here, Jason. I don't know how many times you've listened to us, but if it's been many, you've heard me say this several times in the past. Aside from being a small-letter libertarian, the reason I'm not a large-letter libertarian is because I am pro-U.S., military force where necessary. I'm a 25-year retired military veteran. So my opinion about what goes on, what's going on in Iraq is how many heads do they have to chop off before we get pissed off? I mean, how many American heads have to hit the pavement before we are incensed enough to go fix it? And when I say go fix it, let me say, we have misused the United States military in everything we've done since the Second World War. The United States military is the most powerful killing machine in the world, and that's the only way it should ever be used. And the only time it should ever be used is when we've reached the point where nothing else works. And when we've reached that point, we don't go over and say, we're going to pussyfoot through the streets of your city and only kill one-third of the bad guys, and then we're going to go home. We go there, we say we are pissed off at you, you did this thing to us, and we're going to kill you all until you grovel for mercy. And that's the only way to use the United States military. That's the only legitimate way to use it, and that's why you wait until you have exhausted every other possibility besides the military option before you use it. But yes, we need to be incensed with what's going on over there. Not because they're not a democracy. We have no business caring what kind of government the people over there choose to continue for themselves. There's enough people over there that they can grab pitchforks and hoes and take their government if they want it. We need to be pissed off because they are thumbing their nose at us, and in spite of everything we've done to try to make it different, they are cutting off the heads of American citizens in the street, and we need to say, we've had it.
If I could interject here.
Yes.
On ISIS, I would like to quote a Vietnamese general referring to the French, if you kill enough of them, they won't come back.
That's right. So what else, Jason?
I was going to explain of my opinion. Like, I was agreeing with what you just said there. Like, I honestly think that we should wait until, like, every single possibility is exhausted. Like, we have no other reason, no other way. but to use lethal force. But the current problem in the United States is we're not using that correctly. We're not using our military correctly.
You're right. I wish I'd said that. You know, the only just war in my mind that we have fought since the Second World War, Jason, is Afghanistan. And we did that wrong. We did that wrong. You know, Afghanistan sheltered Al-Qaeda, who came, in fact, fostered Al-Qaeda. The Taliban basically was Al-Qaeda, who came over here and killed without any
remorse,
reservations, without any conscience, and for no reason, 3,000 innocent Americans on their way to work in the morning, drinking their morning coffee. It was time at that point for us to do exactly what I said, to just go kill them all. I mean, that is the point where you say George Bush made his first mistake when he said this is not a war against Muslims. I'm not suggesting that it was a war against Muslims. I'm suggesting that the word Muslim never needed to be introduced. It wouldn't have mattered whether they were Roman Catholics or Southern Baptists or Muslims. You killed 3,000 innocent Americans. You are going to die.
Yes.
It's that simple.
Yeah. That is actually, I really like how you explain that. Oh, crap. Hang on. Something just happened. something happened to my computer. All right. Yeah, I agree with what you say. I believe that America should be, I don't believe we should execute every single member in our government. I believe we should kick out every single person in our government, take honest, trustworthy citizens that, of course, has some experience with economics and politics and stuff like that, and just replace everything to the point where we have a brand new, fresh government that's not corrupt.
That's it. We're taking over.
That's good.
Thanks, Jason.
No problem. Also, other than the ISIS, when do you think we'll actually start using military force to intervene?
Not when this president's sitting in the White House. I mean, not in the way we should. I have no doubt that once he gets his coalition of forces together, that we'll go over and we'll do some more mamby-pamby stuff, and we'll pull out before it's time, and we'll be looking at what we're looking at now when the next president's in. And if the next president's no better than this one or no better than George Bush, not to make it simply a Democrat problem, it's never going to get better. I mean, until we are incensed enough with people who behead Americans in streets on videotape to go over and fix the problem, and I don't think this president can do it. And if we elect another George Bush or another Barack Obama, I don't think they have the testicular fortitude to do it. It won't get better until we take that problem and fix it. It won't get better. We are becoming increasingly the laughing stock to these people.
Yeah, it's ridiculous how we're just like suddenly we're the most powerful country in the world and are being laughed at by tiny countries because we can't go into a simple like terrorist cave and kill the leader.
Thanks for the call, Jake.
No problem. All right, I'll see you later, Dave.
Okay, let's see. Where were we?
Translating Jason's call back to state issues.
Right.
And the threat of violence. I had a daydream while I was sitting in my chair this afternoon thinking about this issue with Deal or No Deal. And, you know, the representatives are afraid of him.
Yes.
But government should be afraid of the people.
Exactly.
I was thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a large group in Jefferson City surrounding the legislative building, carrying pitchforks and torches, like an old Boris Karloff Frankenstein film, with the villagers going after the monster.
Yeah, or like Lexington and Concord.
Yeah, do you think we could get 100 people to carry torches and pitchforks to Jeff City?
I would think that that would make a good point. We might try to do something like that. You know, who was it? Who is it, Mike? Where government fears the people, there is liberty. Where people fear the government, there is tyranny. That's not Jefferson.
Okay.
Who is that? Is that Hamilton?
One of our scholars on here might remember, Laura and Doreen.
I know the quote, but I can't remember who said it.
I think it's Hamilton, but I'm not sure. But that, you know, that is a brilliant piece of foresight. Well, in hindsight, given what they had come from, by one of our formidable founding fathers, where the government fears the people, there is liberty. Where the people fear the government, there is tyranny. Okay, so we need to find this person who will take on the challenge, and then. And I don't suppose we finalize that portion of it from a grassroots perspective until at least after the election, right? I mean, we've got to wait till after the November election just to be absolutely sure who's in and who's out. I mean, we could start laying the groundwork for it today, I'm sure. But you know, I mean, there's an outside chance that Mike Moon or Kurtman or whoever anybody has in mind, not Kevin Engler, won't be there. So, it's Romine, and I'm sorry, it was Romine that Varner was running against, Engler's handpicked replacement in the House of Representatives before he moved over to the Senate, or the other way around.
The way around, right?
Yeah, the other way around.
Engler went from the Senate down to the House, and we definitely don't want Engler to be Speaker of the House.
No. and Romine, his former chief of staff in the Senate, replaced him in that Senate seat. Another undocumented Democrat. At that point, now, when that is done, what we need to do, folks, and I'm not saying this for the sake of the ladies or the gentlemen here, but for you, because this needs to be a game plan, and it needs to be an organized game plan. What we need to do is we need everyone here, every Liberty group in Missouri, to make it clear to their House member that this is what we the people want, that they work for us the people. We need rallies, we need phone calls, we need emails, we need every bit of it, all the pressure we can bring to bear, because this is not going to be an easy endeavor. I'm telling you, this guy is all but anointed at this point in time. Am I right?
Yeah, he's the crown prince.
Yeah,
he's the crown prince. Yeah,
and the power of the entire state party is going to be exactly what you're up against. You folks who we talk to and converse with week after week after week, who say, you know, I still believe in the basic principles of the Republican Party. I think we can save our party. This is it, folks. I mean, this is the kind of battle you are talking about. Your party, if you are liberty-minded, is embarrassing the hell out of you every day in Jefferson City. We're not talking about Washington, D.C. We're talking about your sovereign state, the level of government that should be the level of government that governs your everyday life.
Hey, David.
Yes, ma'am.
I think this is Doreen, and I think it's pretty important that people are aware of this. Now, Laura mentioned earlier that Deal had received about $700,000 in campaign contributions. Well, when Deal decided that he, or
when they decided that Deal was going to be the crown prince for the House, he came out and offered to submit his campaign funds, a percentage of his campaign funds, to the state Republican Party campaign fund. So he's promoting the party powers that exist.
Certainly.
And, you know, and there's, yeah, well, and there's an awful lot of this political money laundering that goes on that people are unaware of, you know. So it's this is a money issue, and this is a back scratching issue with Deal.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing what his handlers want him to do, and he's contributing to the continued hold on the Republican Party by a power structure that's unelected and unaccountable, and that's unacceptable. Okay,
and Matt, you're so please speaking about that HRCC committee, correct, during the House Public...
Yes. Thank you.
That does all the publicizing for... I believe Deal has given them over $350,000 in the last year or so, and they do all the publicizing for candidates, Republican candidates. They recruit Republican candidates.
For you who've been following us for the last 6 months, this is the Republican Party that gathered this money from the man who wants to be Speaker of the House is the Republican Party that mounted a primary campaign against Mike Moon.
Right. Exactly.
There you go, folks.
And they can send out these flyers for or against anybody. And let's say you're a representative. They don't have to tell you or show you anything, even if they're sending it out for you, supposedly.
Right.
You can wake up in the morning and find out that they've sent something terrible out that you would never have sent out about your opponent. That would drive me crazy if I were running.
20 minutes. What do you got for us down there, Mike?
I was just going to say I am a Republican member of my county committee, and I was pretty upset with the state party for supporting Amendment 1 publicly that I was so opposed to, and quite a few other things. I'm fond of saying 100% of the Democratic Party is against me, 80% of the Republican Party is against me. I'm just trying to save that 20%. Sometimes like a lost cause. We have on the line also Terrence from Lakeland, Florida, who wanted to make a comment. And
Terrence,
his mic is live. Terrence?
Yes. Listening to y'all, my first concern was how many people around the world does the United States need to kill before they'll finally accept the Constitution and their freedom? Why don't they just leave other countries alone? That's my first thought.
My
response to that, Terrence, would be whenever they quit cutting the heads off Americans, we will not bother them.
Well, my response to that would be they're not cutting the heads off Americans in any of these United States. So if an American wants to go to China and risk his life, he's free to do that. But in the United States, and our borders are limited, our authority to touch people, I suppose, is within our borders. And when the president goes to Guantanamo, Iraq, Russia, he takes that Constitution with him. And if he's without the Constitution, he's not the president. And that Constitution says no man shall be denied life, liberty, property without due process of law. And when we're over there depriving people of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, which we aren't, have no right to enforce over there, the United States is a bully and is in the wrong.
Terrence,
when acts of war are committed against us, we have a tradition overseas dating from the time of Thomas Jefferson, who sent the Marines and Navy against the Barbary pirates, of defending our citizens' rights to live and exist in other countries. I've been accused of never saying anything nice about Barack Obama, but I'll disprove that tonight. He's done one thing I approve of, and that is drone strikes. And I have gotten awfully tired of hearing some folks on the right and some libertarians complaining about an American citizen who was killed by a drone strike without due process of law because that man was in a war zone committing acts of war against his country. He forfeited his citizenship and any constitutional protections he had by committing acts of war against his country. So, sorry, Terrence, I strongly disagree with your opinion.
Terrence,
my question to you is this. Did I hear you contend that the protections and liberties of the United States Constitution apply to everyone in the world, not just to American citizens?
They don't necessarily apply to American citizens at all. The people didn't make a set of rules to place upon themselves. They made a set of rules to put actors in government position. So the Constitution applies to people in government, not to the people.
You're absolutely right. It applies to the people in government, and it specifically says that one of the very limited functions of the federal government is to protect our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Well, to protect our liberties.
Let me stop you right there. To defend, not to protect. I would say defend, not protect, because the only way
to defend our liberties, and then there are some specific liberties that are defended, and they are specified in the First Ten Amendments, and did I just hear you contend that those protections or defenses of those liberties apply as a function of the United States government to everyone in the world?
No.
Did I hear you say or not that under the United States Constitution, that we must give anyone we bomb in Al-Qaeda due process of law?
Yes, and part of that due process is Congress actually declaring and debating war.
Oh, you've never heard me argue that point with you. I argued that we've used the military badly. I've argued that we've used the military illegally. I've argued all those things. I argue that we do not do anything until the United States Congress declares a war. So I'm with you there.
I agree.
I'm with you, Terrence, on the issue of, you know, we're not using the military properly, and two, we've got our southern border that's wide flipping open, and our federal government is in total violation of our Constitution and the parameters that they are supposed to uphold. And it doesn't necessarily apply in the middle of a desert in any other country. It applies here on our borders and within our states, and it's not being followed here. So, I don't think it's necessarily an act of war to kill people in another country, you know, if you're an ISIS terrorist or something. But I think that we have to have our Constitution followed, and Congress needs to declare war, and if we're going to go to war, we go to war to win.
Yes.
If you look at it that way, it's sort of like our founders would have been classified as terrorists.
Because?
Mm-hmm.
What the British called them, mm-hmm.
So
the FBI referred to them as such.
When we're over there for hundreds of years, and I'm thinking of the General Smedley Butler, War of the Racket. You know,
yep.
The United States has caused so much chaos all around the world for the businessmen. It's so ridiculous. That's why I said our governors, you know, the people in Texas, they're going on the border and they're complaining about the immigrants when it's not their land. You know, my land is my acre, your land is your acre. If someone comes onto my acre, I have some say. But if they come mm-hmm. onto your acre, I can help you, but you can tell me go away. Don't help
mm-hmm.
me. But to say that a man or woman entering into this country seeking freedom has to ask for permission, the only way you can require them to ask for permission is to make sure everybody already here has permission. And when we have to ask for permission, which everyone has to beg the government and purchase permission to sustain their life, it's called slavery, no matter what you call it. When you force immigrants to come in legally, that means you're telling me I have to prove I have a legal right to be here. And that creates slavery. So there's got to be a different way of attacking the problem, which is I think the CIA is shipping people up here on purpose. That's just my best guess, because no one's going to travel 1,000 miles to come somewhere with nothing to eat.
That depends on how much less than nothing you to eat you have where you left. I mean, the poor Israelis had nothing to eat when they fled Egypt. So
yeah, but they didn't. I mean, I can leave Michigan if I'm starving, but how near to Florida am I going to get before I starve to death? There's some mechanism bringing those people here, and it's not their own volition.
You're not going to get any argument out of me on that, Terrence. I'm with you 100%. Now I do want to clear up one more point though, and then we've got to move on with tonight's subject.
Okay.
Do you then contend that the defenses to my liberty that I am entitled to from the federal government by virtue of the contract between the states and the federal government ends when I set foot in a foreign country? So the federal government has no more responsibility to defend my life and liberty because I've stepped foot inside another country, my head is fair game?
I would say that is correct.
Okay. Well, you and I will disagree on that.
Because,
point.
And my reason is, if you can drag a group of people with you and expect them and compel them to perform for yourself, then you're not free. Well, you're not free at all. If you go to China, you have to do as the Chinese do. But you can't drag me and my son and my daughter along with you to make sure you travel safely. In the United States, you can, but really you can't compel anyone to defend you here. That's conscription, and that's slavery. But here it's I can volunteer to help you and defend you. But when you go overseas or you go somewhere else, you're on your own, and you have to make your
now,
way
I have,
there.
I have no argument with you, Terrence, if I go to Turkey and sell drugs. I have no argument with you if I go to Iran or Iraq or one of those countries and I drink beer out in the street against their laws. But I do have argument with you when a body that is an arm of a foreign government kidnaps an innocent American and holds them for ransom, and when that ransom is not met, cuts their head off in the town square. That's
okay.
That's
when that ransom, when the United States forbid, but the United States forbid the family from paying the ransom. The United States had a hand in that. It didn't happen on its own. They wanted a ransom. Okay, give the guy the Fed can print $1 trillion. Give them their $1 million. Let the guy go. But when they say no, we will not. Well, why not? They've given it to every other bank on the face of the planet. Why not give this? It doesn't make sense that you can't pay a ransom for one American, but yet they can give a foreign country $10 billion a year to buy.
I agree
war
with
stuff.
You. I agree with you.
So
it
the
is
United
wrong
States
to give
a hand in it.
And Terrence is referring to the statement from the Foley family that they were forbidden by the State Department to pay
ransom. Right. I understand. I understand. I understand what he's saying.
But I'd also say that if we weren't there in the first place for the past 50 years, we wouldn't be having our heads cut off. And the treaties of the United States are supposed to be in pursuit of the Constitution. So when they make a treaty, say, with Iran, they take the Constitution and say, this is how we want you to treat our people when they visit your country. Here's our Constitution. These are the rules we apply. And they get these certain rights when they are here. If you will agree to treat our people like that, we will do the same for your people when they come here. And everything is peaceful. And when the foreign country refuses, then the treaty's cut off. And it's that simple. There doesn't need to be all this other conflict and things. It's the Constitution, and it goes with every politician wherever they go around the world. They take that with them and say,
thanks,
here's
Terrence.
How we act.
Thanks, Terrence.
And thank you guys very much.
You got the last word on that one, I promise. All right, we've got to get back to it. We've got to get back to it here. We've got 5 minutes left, so I would like to start with Doreen. Doreen, wrap up what you want the listeners to get out of tonight.
Predominantly the role of the Speaker of the House and how powerful position that is, and converse with your representative about who would be a good freedom-oriented Speaker of the House, not a party lackey who will do what the power structure wants, but someone who will do what the people need in that position.
All right. All right, just quickly, about half of 20,000 people right now are completely new to this process. What do you do? Do you just pick up the phone and call your representative and say, hey, I want to chat about this for a moment?
Yes. Say you understand that the position of speaker is terribly, terribly powerful, and that we have to have someone who is dedicated to freedom principles in that position, and who do they think would be a good person for that?
Okay. Thanks for being with us. Exactly. Thanks for being with us tonight, Doreen. Liberty Roundtable, Truth Farmer. How do we get a hold of the Liberty Roundtable or the Truth Farmer?
Well, you can go to my website, truthfarmer.com, or you can send me an email at animalwaitress@gmail.com.
Doreen Hannes, thank you very much. Laura Hausladen from Missourians for Honest Elections, wrap up what you want these listeners to take away from tonight, please.
I second what Doreen says, and make sure that you understand that this gentleman, as floor leader, refused. There was a bill that passed the Senate with a wide majority, and he refused to let that bill go to the floor of the House for a vote. So that's
which bill was that?
Showing that was the paper ballot bill.
The paper ballot bill.
Right. That just shows the kind of totalitarian sort that he is, and that's why we don't want him in leadership, especially Speaker of the House. And Doreen is right. You need to contact your rep. If you don't, calling is great. At this point, you probably won't find them in their office, but they should be leaving some sort of information on how to get a hold of them. And so start by calling whatever number you can, and then try the email if that doesn't work. And let them know, even if you can't have a conversation with them, let them know that you do not want John Deal to be the next Speaker of the House, and you do not want them to vote for John Deal to be Speaker of the House. You will consider that poor form.
Laura Hausladen, Missourians for Honest Elections, Missourians for Sound Money, one of the powerhouses behind the paper ballot bill in Jefferson City. We hope to have these two ladies back. We'll talk about this a little bit more in the future. We'll try to get this thing a little bit more organized for you folks. Thanks again, Laura.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mike, great show. We've got about 60 seconds left. What do you got to say?
Well, it's obvious John Deal went to the Attila the Hun School of Government for his training.
yes.
I think the most important thing that Deal has said that we should remember is he doesn't care what the people think. Okay.
I agree. I agree. Okay, folks. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, house.mo.gov is where you can find out who your state rep is. You can get his email address, his office number, and if he's not there, he has an assistant, legislative aides, and he has voicemail.
Correct.
If everybody listening calls, that will have an impact.
Next week, Mike Moon, hopefully Bob Parker, and one more time, Mike, the guy's name.
Rick Vandeveren.
Rick Vandeveer.
Candidate for 8th District Congress.
Join us then. Thanks, Mike. Good night.
Night. Take care.
You too.
There are so many contradictions in all these messages we send. Keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit in? Though the world is